Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk. I guess this is the last talk of what's been a very intense and very interesting workshop. Maybe we'll have some final discussion tomorrow. Since I know we're all tired, and I am too, I'll try to be brief because I'm not sure I have energy to do otherwise. I'm gonna tell you about a fermionic duel of the O4 model. I guess yesterday, although I wasn't there, I listened to most of the talk online. Igor told us, among other things, about an ADS duel of the ON model. There's not going to be any gravity in this talk. I'm going to tell you about a field theory duel of the O4 vector model, and everything I say will be in three dimensions or two plus one dimensions. I'll start just by telling you why this might be a worthwhile thing to do, just by giving an example where it certainly is worthwhile to have an example where we have an example we understand, and we can extract some useful information from it. Then I'll state what this is. I'll tell you, well, I think you know what the O4 vector model is, but I'll remind you of that, and I'll tell you what this field theory is. Then I'll give you some evidence that this duality is actually true. The first thing is that I'll essentially derive it, and you can see whether you believe whether it's really a derivation or not, from a lattice model. Then I'll try to set up an operator dictionary between these two field theories, and monopoles will play a really crucial role there, actually. That's why there are monopoles in the title. Let me just start with an example. Suppose somebody gave you this field theory, which is a familiar field theory. We have a U1 gauge field coupled to a complex scalar, and we have some Maxwell action for the gauge field, and let's say we have a mass term for the scalar. This is some kind of Abelian-Higgs model. It also describes the finite temperature physics of three-dimensional superconductors. It's just the Landau-Ginzburg model. One thing that's, you know, been known about this model for a very long time is that if you try to, of course, if you just try to do perturbation theory between this complex scalar field and the gauge field, the perturbation theory is not well-behaved. You get infrared divergences. One thing you could try to do is understand this in a 4-epsilon expansion. What you find actually is that you actually don't find any stable fixed point just below four dimensions unless you have 365 or more scalar fields, one for every day of the year. Here I just had one or two, depending on how you count. I would conclude, well, this theory doesn't, maybe it just in three dimensions, just doesn't have a stable fixed point, doesn't have a stable critical fixed point. We know that's not true. Where does it come from? I don't think it has any special significance, but I mean, yeah, it comes from the epsilon expansion. You do one loop RG calculation controlled by the dimensionality just below four dimensions. Yeah. But we know, going back to Peskin and to Dasgupta and Halperin, that this field theory is dual to the XY model. Okay. So just another complex field, but no gauge field. This we know well has a Wilson-Fischer fixed point. We know it from large N expansion, epsilon expansion, and also very, very large scale numerical simulations. So that means that the conclusion we drew about this field theory from the epsilon expansion was just wrong, and indeed it does have a nice second order phase transition. So what's the point? Yeah, I know. Yeah. We all know that first order transitions can always happen. I'm not telling you about what does happen, I'm just telling you about what can happen. And you might have concluded from this analysis that it can't happen, but that's wrong. Yeah. So why am I telling you this example, which is very well known? So this is a case where if someone just gave you this field theory, it's very useful to know that it's dual to some other field theory, which has all the same low energy, long wavelength properties, at least near the critical fixed point. So that's great. So what's true is that suppose we have field theories with abelian global symmetries. Only with bosonic fields and only abelian gauge fields. Then essentially for such theories, we basically have a crank that we can turn. There are many ways in which to turn it, I could, for example, write down some lattice version of this model, and by making appropriate transformations to the partition function, I could wind up with this field theory. Okay, and there are many different versions of that. But as soon as we have anything non-abelian, either global symmetries or gauge symmetries or fermions, we don't have this anymore. Okay. Now, there are some exceptions to this, or at least there are certain cases where there are examples of duals, kind of like this one, where we do have non-abelian symmetries and or fermions. And so the exceptions are primarily two-dimensional conformal field theories where you can actually just view bosonization as an example of a duality. And there are also supersymmetric examples in various dimensions. Okay. But especially if we're interested in studying some of the interesting 2+1 dimensional conformal field theories you get in condensed matter systems, first of all, then we're no longer in 1+1 dimension, and second of all, generally, one doesn't have supersymmetry. So it would be nice some duals of non-abelian conformal field theories in three dimensions, which would be some other CFT3s without supersymmetry. And actually, I'm going to get greedy and add an additional restriction, and you'll see why I want to add this restriction a little later. I also don't want topological terms in my action. And so the reason for that is basically, and we'll meet an example which is of this type in a little bit, so I'll illustrate it more concretely. But the reason I don't want topological terms is that really I want both field theories to be things that I can calculate in some controllable way, right? That's true in this first example. Both those theories have 4-epsilon expansions, large N expansions, and so on. A lot of the time when you have topological terms, that's just not true anymore. There's no way to deform the theory and get something you can calculate with. Okay. So I'll give you one example. So actually these theories will both be fermionic duals of the O4 vector model. And in fact, they sort of start from the same place. So one of these has a topological term. And because of that, I'm not going to focus on it too much, but we'll kind of get to it on the way to the other one. So this is work That I did with Jason Alicia, Lexi Motrinich, and Matthew Fisher a few years ago. And then more recently, so this I'll focus on more. I'll give you an example without a topological term. And so this is something I did just a few months ago. And I haven't yet, but I will put references on the, so you can look these papers up. You can get both of these things on the archive. Okay. So without further ado, let me just state what the duality is. And I'm actually going to start with this one, because this is the one that we're focusing on. Okay. This, we're just going to sort of, it'll come up as an aside as I'm talking about the derivation of the duality, but I'm not going to focus on it. Okay. So I really want examples without topological terms. So, okay. So we have the O4 vector model. It's got some field, some four-component real field, and it's convenient, actually, for various purposes, to organize this into a complex 2x2 matrix, which I'll call script Z. Which you can write in this way. So the first component times the identity matrix plus the other three components dotted into Pauli matrices. Another useful thing, I need to define a bunch of notation, so it's best just to get that out of the way. It's possible to write such a 2x2 matrix in the following form. I have some Z1 and Z2. You can see that, you know, I only have four real fields, so these four components are not all independent. So it's also useful to define a two-component complex field, which I'll just call capital Z. Okay. And if I demand that this field has unit length, then this matrix is just an element of SU2. Okay. So why is it useful to write things in this way? Well, the reason is that SO4, the SO4 symmetry, is just SU2 cross SU2. There's some discrete factor that won't play a big role. And so these SU2s are left and right rotations of this matrix. Okay. So that's going to play an important role. You'll see why in a second. So, right. I noticed that you wrote down the same equation in your talk, actually. So this is one point of contact, but I think there's a more significant, maybe more significant point of contact later on. So it's easiest actually to write down the Lagrangian in terms of this object. So I'll just do it. And the reason for actually writing it down is that I also want to add, for reasons that will be clear soon, I want to add some term that actually breaks the O4 symmetry down. So actually this term breaks the O4 symmetry to U1 cross U1. So it's some kind of anisotropy term. And that has to do with where this model will be coming from when we derive it from a lattice model. So it's going to be important for us to keep track of this operator. The reason why is that this operator is relevant at the O4 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay. And of course, so is this. So we're going to have two relevant directions to contend with. Okay, so that's the O4 model that we all know and love. So what's the theory that I claim this is dual to, in the sense that it has all the same low energy properties? So I'll take Dirac fermions, and I'm going to couple them to two different gauge fields. I'll couple them to a U1 gauge field, and let me just call this sigma clearer. So let me also Okay, so what have I written here? This is, you know, nothing but Dirac fermions. This is our U1 gauge field, SU2 gauge field. Now, of course, these gauge fields have Maxwell dynamics. There's no Chern-Simons term for them allowed by symmetry, and I haven't written that. And the two operators that I have written explicitly, which are operators that to be identified later, are the two operators that I claim correspond to these two relevant directions. Okay, but I haven't told you what those are yet. And in fact, these operators, I can't really completely determine what they are. Yeah, that's the next thing I'm going to tell you. So there are NF equals 2 four-component fermions. So in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the fundamental Dirac fermion, if you don't have any non-abelian gauge fields to contend with, is a two-component object. Okay, but since we have the SU2 gauge field, really the fundamental object that we can make, which is transforms as the fundamental of SU2, has four components. So that's what I mean. Sigma and gamma commute, yeah. Yeah, so they act, so it, this, these things live in some, so they live in a tensor product space. It's actually useful to say this explicitly. So there's gammas, there are sigmas, and then there are another set of Pauli matrices. And so these things generate the SU2 flavor symmetry. Okay. Yeah, two com. Well, this is in two. This is in 2 plus 1 dimension. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, look, the Lorentz group has only one, it's not like, I don't know if this is what you're referring to. It's not like in 3 plus 1 dimensions where you have two different irreducible representations of the Lorentz group and you have left and right fermions. Yeah, but I'm not going to. Okay, well, we have time reversal symmetry, so you're not allowed to add it. Yeah, but that, no, I don't think that leads to any problem. And, well, those masses are also forbidden by symmetries, too, as it turns out. But. So for now, you can just say SU2 flavor symmetry plus parity and time reversal. What really forbids it is the symmetries of the lattice model from which this thing originates. Some, you know, the space group is embedded in some way in the SU2 flavor. So I need to say a couple of other things, which maybe I wanted to say here. Yeah, so I'll comment on that too. I'm claiming that there is one, yeah. So first of all, let me just make some sort of general statements about this theory and start to think about comparing it with this theory. Okay. So the first thing, we have a global symmetry, which is SU, so just the continuous global symmetry is, I don't want to call that flavor. So I have the SU2 flavor symmetry that we talked about. There's also a symmetry that I'll call U. And so what this is just a symmetry whose current is the flux of the U1 gauge field. Okay. And so this is a non-compact U1 gauge field. That's why we have this symmetry. That's what it means, actually, for the gauge field to be non-compact. One thing that's obvious immediately is that So one thing that's obvious immediately is that the manometry of this action is flux. It's just because the charge is the flux of the gauge field. Yeah. So the manifest global symmetry of this theory is less than the manifest global symmetry of the O4 model, certainly if we turn off this term. No, because the U1 part of that is gauged, right? That's gauged by this gauge field. Well, there are two gauge fields. There's a U, or you could say there's a U2 gauge field if you like. There's a global SU2 flavor. Correct. Yeah. All right. So. All right. So if these theories are going to be dual, the minimum thing that we need. Okay. So let me first say one thing. So I'm gonna identify this with one of the SU2s of this O4. So there are left and right SU2s. I'm going to call this one SU2 left. And so what we need at a minimum for these theories to be dual is that this U1 flux, at least at the O4 fixed point, needs to be enlarged to SU2 right. Okay. Yes, I didn't write them, actually. Well, you can and should add them, right? So, right. So one will get them. Right. Well, maybe this is a good place to say what we know about field theories of this type. So basically, everything that we know comes from a the limit of a large number of flavors, so we can take that limit here, and in that limit we know that we have a critical fixed point for some sufficiently large number of flavors. Well, you don't know the fixed point action, right? I mean, so it's not even. Yeah. Which? Oh. So I said those are operators to be identified later. No, we don't. Yeah, No. You don't know that's true. I actually think it's very likely to be true, and so I think it is true here unless you tune these two parameters to reach a single critical fixed point where it's not true. Okay. Yeah, but remember I started the talk by giving you an example where the 4 minus epsilon expansion for a theory which is in some ways rather similar gives completely misleading information about exactly this question. So I claim that that's not to be trusted at all. Well, I mean, I gave you an example where it's not to be trusted, so why do you trust it? Thanks. I wish I knew how to do that. And so I wish I knew how to do that. It's definitely not true that theory is the same as large N in the ON model. That's, yeah. When I start to set up a dictionary, you'll be able to see immediately that that's not going to work. All right, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to back off a little bit. So this statement that I made is basically the result of the talk, but I haven't really explained it yet. So now what I want to do is try to start giving you some evidence for it. And so so I want to basically derive this duality from a lattice model. Okay. So let me tell you what the strategy is. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down some XY model on the lattice. And it turns out that this will be a particular kind of XY model where at low energy I get one, not just one, but two complex fields. And so I'll explain how that works. Okay. But since this is an XY model, on the lattice, I can microscopically apply my duality crank, and so I can get a dual version of this Hamiltonian. And then the low energy limit of that, okay, or as a low energy effective theory of this Hamiltonian, I'll get this theory. Oh, and so why am I calling it QCED3? Well, quantum chromoelectrodynamics, I guess. Okay, so that's the strategy, all right? So now let me write down the lattice XY model. And I think the first thing I need to do, especially because it's a construction I suspect is not familiar to many of the string theorists in the audience, I need to explain how you get two complex fields out of this XY model. Okay. So I'm going to write down a Hamiltonian form of this. And I'll tell you what all these objects are in a second. Okay, so on every site, I have some canonically conjugate variables, n and phi. And so n has integer eigenvalues, and phi is some 2 pi periodic phase variable. So this, if you like, is a quantum rotor Hamiltonian. And the crucial thing here, so this term, so what this term does is it wants to make n small, and this term favors some kind of magnetic ordering. You can think of it as magnetic ordering of this phase field phi. Okay. And the crucial thing actually is that because J is positive, what this wants the phis to do is to be opposite to one another instead of parallel to one another. So this is an XY antiferromagnet on the triangular lattice. Okay. So so people have studied this model a lot, actually. Actually, the model that people really study a lot numerically is not the Hamiltonian version of the model, but the equivalent classical stat-mech model in three dimensions, which is just stacked triangular lattices. And so schematically, the phase diagram looks as follows. So actually, what people also do is they add an extra term, which I may as well write. So this is like it's some cosine 2 phi term. What this says is that these phase fields would like to either be parallel to one another or anti-parallel, but they don't care which. Okay. So this favors actually basically the pneumatic order that Eduardo was talking about. So the phase diagram looks something like this, very schematically. There's a paramagnetic phase when these J's are small. And then there are two different ordered phases. Where this field acquires an expectation value, and I'll draw this ordering pattern just for fun in a second. And this is an O4 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay. And indeed, if you Let me come to that in a second, because I'm actually going to go through that analysis. I still haven't told you where I'm from. For completeness, what does this ordered state look like? Well, what happens is that these things want to point 120 degrees apart from one another, and so you get some state that looks like this. Okay, so you start with one triangle like that. From that, you can cover the whole lattice. So what's going to happen, I think I've said enough to basically answer your question without getting too far ahead of myself. So this current in the gauge theory is actually a well-known thing from this XY duality, will be equivalent to the U1 conserved current of this theory that I started with. This field, so inserting a bosonic field in the original theory, inserting a monopole in the fermionic theory. So if I want to know how to insert bosonic fields, I have to know how to insert monopoles in the fermionic side. Yeah, but that's getting a little bit ahead. So where does the O4 come from? So, I mean, one thing I should say is that in models of frustrated magnetism like this one, having a larger number of low energy degrees of freedom is something that's actually very familiar in condensed matter systems. It happens all the time. This is sort of a particularly nice, simple example of it. So let me just write down the imaginary time functional integral for this system, and I'll drop this term now. All right, this is just a sigma model, right, on the lattice. So what I would rather do, rather than work with a sigma model, is I'd like to replace this field by an arbitrary complex field rather than something that has unit magnitude. This is a legitimate thing to do, and what you should think of is doing some amount of coarse graining in the time direction, but not doing any coarse graining in space. So you keep the lattice structure, but nonetheless you still do some coarse graining, and then the unit magnitude constraint on this field will go away, and you'll get some complex field. And so you can write down an effective action in terms of that field. And so the crucial part let me add this term as well. So there are various other nonlinear terms in particular that I need to add, but for these purposes I'm not going to add them. Because this will be enough to explain where the O4 is actually coming from. So now what we can do is we can actually just, so this term is still on the lattice, but what we can do is we can go to reciprocal space and we can just diagonalize the quadratic part of the action. It's not linear in time derivatives. And that's forbidden by the particle hole symmetry of the original model, which is n goes to minus n. So that term is forbidden by symmetry. So so when you do that exercise, so the Brillouin zone of the triangular lattice is a hexagon, what you find is that there are two special points in reciprocal space, actually all of these corners. This corner and this corner, these three corners are all equivalent, actually, by reciprocal lattice vectors. So there are two distinct corners. And if you plot, so what I actually want to plot is the action as a function of, what I want to do is choose some configuration of my field phi that varies at some wave vector, and I calculate the action of that field, and I plot it just on this cut going through kx, and what I get is something that basically looks like this. So let me call this point k, minus k. So this is minus k. This is k. And so I have these two modes that don't cost much action. And in fact, these are related by various lattice symmetries. So for example, if I rotate by 60 degrees, these two minima actually go into one another. So they have to be degenerate. And so what I've plotted here is actually for R positive, so that we're in the paramagnetic state, at least at mean field theory. But if you make R lower, these two things come down and condense at the same time. And that's how you get an O4 model. Okay. Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I can tell you two things. I can tell you that, first of all, when people do numerics on this model, this is indeed the phase diagram. And I don't know if there are ways to change some other parameter to get a phase diagram that looks different. The other thing I can tell you is that this is also the phase diagram you get if you just do mean field theory. You just treat this as a Landau theory. So actually, you just treat this thing within mean field theory. This is the phase diagram you get. Yeah. I'm not sure how I would get it. I could have said that, but I wanted to explain this in a more microscopic way. No, I don't understand the statement you made, actually. You mean for this transition? For? Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, right, yeah. So what you're saying is you can't get this transition in 4 minus epsilon expansion, for example. Right. And so there are big arguments in the numerical literature about whether this is a second order or first order transition. But I have absolutely nothing to say about that. Okay, so the point now is that the long wavelength physics is just controlled by configurations of the field that look as follows. So all I'm saying is that we can focus on the fluctuations of this field near these two points. So these are the rapidly oscillating parts. These are some slowly varying functions on the scale of the lattice. And actually, it's a function of R and tau, that's what I meant. Right. So these two fields, Z1 and Z2, combine to give us our O4 field, which I was calling Z or calling various other things. Okay. So now I can identify, so I was talking about SU2 left here, so let me tell you specifically what SU2 left actually means. So what SU2 left does is it just takes this and it applies an SU2 matrix to it. So actually SU2 left is completely broken down to some discrete subgroup once you include all the effects of the lattice and everything else, right? So it mixes up these two points, but it doesn't contain any of the actual microscopic U1 symmetry, okay? So we also have the microscopic U1 symmetry, which I'll call UNXY, and what that does is it just takes Z and rotates it everywhere by a phase, okay? And finally, the last thing I should say, U1XY is a subgroup of SU2Right. And so SU2Right, the best way to see what it is just to look at that matrix and ask what happens to it when I multiply it on the right by an SU2 matrix. Okay, so that's really pretty simple stuff, actually, so far. So I've completed the first step of this strategy, which is to go from this lattice model to the O4 model. So now what I need to do is construct a dual lattice model. Okay, and so I'm not going to derive this at all because it's going to take too long for me to do that. But I will write it down at least. So the important thing is that the degrees of freedom in this dual lattice model don't live on the triangular lattice. They now live on this honeycomb lattice, which is our dual lattice, and also on the bonds of the honeycomb lattice. So what's the Hamiltonian? I'll say some words about what all these objects are in a second. And I'll say nothing about how I derived it, but I will say what these objects correspond to in the original model. Okay, so we've got